What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. And today we've got part two of my conversation with Matthew Spector, which started out as the imperial origins of realism, but has meandered to all kinds of topics about varieties of realism, Weltpolitik versus Realpolitik, the Nazi super weapon known as geopolitics, so-called, all kinds of shit. We're going to finish up that discussion, including what realism offers the left and progressives or does not offer the left and progressives. One thing to note quickly is that I started this conversation that you're about to hear with a question that I finished part one of the conversation with. So part one of the conversation ends with me asking him a question about Dan Nexon's comment that realists are just pessimistic liberals. That's a pretty important framing for the part two of the conversation. So I've put that same question and answer sequence at the top of this episode. So if you're listening to part one and part two back to back, you're going to have that question overlapping, but it's a good time. So listen, have fun, and I'll catch you soon. Peace. Dan Nexon, who's a friend of the pod, professor at Georgetown, I've heard him say a few times that realists are just pessimistic liberals, or he's floating that as a provisional characterization. And I don't necessarily disagree, but it also kind of depends on which realism you're talking about and what you mean by liberal. So what do you think of that? Realists are pessimistic liberals.
I think it's helpful in describing the fact that many Cold War realists were also Cold War liberals. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I think that a lot of my peers who sort of gravitate towards realism as an antidote to the ills of Cold War US foreign policy and post-Cold War US foreign policy, I think downplay the connections between realism and liberalism. For them, the sins of the Cold War liberals can be addressed by becoming more realist, right? Just as you said before, this is the shelf ready, we've got an alternate realism is somehow untainted by liberalism of the Cold War, of its kind of messianic, version in the Cold War, or its unipolar moment. Mm-hmm. And so I would agree with Dan that, the affinity between that realism and liberalism are part of the same family. I mean, Beata Jahn has a great argument in which she says that, realism is sort of the disavowed shadow side of liberalism, that liberalism practices power politics, in fact, but has a bad conscience about it. And so it disavows it and projects it outwards as if it were something completely separate. Mm. In my narrative, realism and liberalism are two faces of empire. Mm-hmm. Empire. So I think that that notion of realism as a pessimistic liberalism is consistent with my argument that realism and liberal internationalism are two faces of empire. Now, maybe Dan wouldn't go in that direction, or maybe he would, but I guess I would look for a more structural reading of realism and liberalism rather than relying on a psychological characterization of a sort of pessimism.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, what's interesting is in IR theory, just purely mm-hmm. in the nuts and bolts of theory making, the community of IR scholars has kind of come around, has unquestionably come around to a framing that says, realism and liberalism are both rationalist projects. It's rationalist ontology all the way down. And so in that sense, they're extremely similar. It denies a social ontology in that sense, and that which makes it so, such a contrast with constructivism or relational theory or Marxism or critical theory. And that's a different toolkit of reasoning to come out in basically the same place, which is that realism and liberalism have a lot in common. And you look at the practice of grand strategy, mm-hmm. primacy is a grand strategy of basically offensive realism and liberal hegemony. I've been struggling with this a lot lately. Liberal hegemony, particularly as practiced by the United States, is primacy with a lot of liberal rhetoric. It's primacy that accounts also for institutions, but it is the same mm-hmm. ontology. Like, there's a lot of like bending over backwards to stress differences between these two things, that like the differences are much smaller than the similarities in a way.
Yeah, completely. And I think that's why I'm frustrated by left realists, you know, because they think that they're, that represents,
that's a great point. Yeah.
An Archimedean point, or, you know, position outside, when in fact it's just kind of part of the same century of imperial thinking.
Mm-hmm. You know, Carl Schmitt, you mentioned him a couple times, famous, infamous Nazi political theorist. He did some very impactful work in spite of that. And then Hans Morgenthau, obviously the father mm-hmm. of classical realism in the U.S., the guy who constructed out of thin air a historical genealogy that goes back to the Peloponnesian War or whatever. What was their relationship to each other? Like, what was Schmitt's impact on Morgenthau?
The influence went both ways. I mean, Morgenthau...
They knew each other.
They knew each other. There are very few letters that you can read in the Library of Congress Morgenthau papers. But, you know, Morgenthau believed that Carl Schmitt had plagiarized key ideas from his dissertation, and that these, that you can, if you look at the two different versions of the concept of the political, you can arguably see, you know, Schmitt stole some ideas from Morgenthau. But the basic Schmitt-Morgenthau argument is about the concept of the political. Mm. And the notion that concept of the political was a book that Schmitt wrote in 1927. It comes out of the Weimar context. And it says that the central definition of the political is the friend-enemy relation. You know, it was this very stark vision of politics and of liberalism's constitutive inability to recognize unresolvable antagonisms between interests. And this is something that still preoccupies political theorists. There's a realist revival, and basically people who are frustrated with Rawls or Habermas or other deliberative Democrats say basically, you know, politics has antagonism that can't be mitigated, that can't be addressed through reason or compromise. Mm-hmm. So that's in part why Schmitt has been attractive to the left. So Morgenthau took those ideas, and in his Scientific Man versus Power Politics, he basically argues that Wilsonian liberalism shares this incapacity to recognize, you know, conflicts of interest that are not adjudicable.
Yeah.
And that one needs to not exaggerate the faith in reason and in law to tame the political, right? That there's something kind of elemental and demonic even about the political sphere, that one can make an effort to bring morality and power, or morality and politics, into some kind of balance. Liberalism's inability to deal with power politics, which we're all familiar with, because we've heard this said about Wilsonianism, we've mm-hmm. heard this said about your Dick Cheney or the neocons critiquing the UN as a talking shop. That's a similar kind of argument about the weakness of law, of reason, of deliberation.
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing politics wrong if you don't orient yourself toward enemies. I mean, you got it. Like, that's kind of like, that's the long and short of my takeaway of Schmitt. And that's the part, yes, of Schmitt that people seem to really like.
Yeah. I mean, my leftist friends would say, you know, a good class politics includes a class enemy, right? Mm. So there is some utility. I mean, having done some organizing as a a lecturer in universities. I understand the power of identifying an enemy in a kind of class struggle. My problem with this is that I think that's not the totality of politics, right? Politics is not only about naming an enemy and mobilizing around it. I don't think that part of Schmidt was very dear to Morgenthau.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you actually about Morgenthau's political evolution, because how would you characterize it? And you just started to get at it there. Like in the Vietnam War years, he was very networked with leftist organizations, like Institute for Policy Studies and others too. Like, was he just the same thing the whole time and the shit that was going on around him changed, or did he have a political evolution? I know towards the end he was advocating a world state. I think
Scheuermann argues that there's some movement towards a more cosmopolitan perspective in the early 60s, mm-hmm. 1961. Others are very impressed with Morgenthau's early and vocal dissent from the Vietnam War, and so I think there was. I don't think his position on Vietnam really shows a significant shift, because his grounds for being against the war were that it was not in the national interest.
Yeah, this is his magic construct. Yeah,
I think this is something I've wrestled with a lot, because William Scheuermann has written really powerful books arguing for Morgenthau as a progressive, mm-hmm. Someone who is more cosmopolitan than has been recognized, who was right on Vietnam. My argument is that he did a lot of damage, even if he later became a dissenter from the policies that flowed from the Cold War. I think that, as I said earlier, it's not just the Cold War liberals who are to blame for Vietnam and the Cold War. It's also the Cold War realists. Mm-hmm. He was embraced by the left because he came from government. He didn't have a principled anti-imperialist stance on Vietnam or other issues. My other critique of Morgenthau is that, I try to show in my chapter, which I call An American Power Politics, that he rejected German power politics, but that he invented an American power politics. And I think that through my kind of close reading of his texts, I argue that it's a little bit unfair that he tried to have his cake and eat it too. He tried to be popular and accessible, but then complained that he had been misunderstood and the nuances had been lost. And I'm not the only person to have argued that. Oliver Utrecht makes a similar argument. So I don't see a tremendous amount of evolution. I mean, I think...
You made a good point about his six principles of political realism. This is kind of an aside, but it kind of reinforces what you're saying. That is the most important thing that was pulled from his book, Politics Among Nations, but it was kind mm-hmm. of incidental to it or happenstance.
Yeah, I can't recall exactly. I think the publisher may have encouraged that, but that was something that he, it's interesting. Both Kennan and Morgenthau, really set these paradigms in motion, but then came very disenchanted with the orthodox realism that flowed. And I try to argue that Morgenthau has to take responsibility for realism's moment of high orthodoxy in the 50s.
I had John Delurie on the show recently about his book Agents of Subversion, and he's not an IR scholar, he's a China historian, but his recent book had a whole chapter on realist intellectual history in the early Cold War. And we talked about it a little bit on the pod, but he commented at one point that he thinks the pernicious thing about Henry Kissinger was that Kissinger popularized stripping realism of its ethical content. And the people who are trying to be saviors of Hans Morgenthau or venerate him today, they try to stress that things like Politics Among Nations had ethical content. What do you make of that? Do you think the thing about Kissinger is right? Ethical realism generally?
I mean, I respect the people who want to insist that Morgenthau had a strong ethical compass. I mean, he certainly did. I don't think that the mediations that he proposed between ethics and foreign policy, or, you know, ethics and power politics, were extremely productive mediations. Mm-hmm. I think they were quite static and sort of doomed to fail. And so ethics is always sort of the add-on. But the people who urge a return to Morgenthau are sometimes coming from neorealism, right, where the system, rather than the nation level politician or decision maker, is at the center. And so, you know, I'm quite happy that neoclassical realists are interested in prudent decision making and sort of putting more agency into the hands of politicians. I think that's all to the good. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think that it's still a very thin, sort of a thin gruel.
It's not enough.
You know, prudential realism is, of course, it's good to be prudent. There are also other intellectual traditions for counseling prudence. So yes, prudence is a good thing. Ethics is a good thing. But I think that this notion of ethical realism, or that classical realism has all the answers, you know, again, is neglecting realism's blind spots.
Yeah.
You know, realism is often, you can sort of see realism is either too thick or too thin. That the sort of the practice of foreign policy is overdetermined by the scientific pretensions of neorealist theory, or that the practice of foreign policy is underdetermined by the classical version of the theory. I mean, one way of talking about classical realism is that it just teaches the art of judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, so the too thick is you've got a theory that explains everything. The too thin is that realism only gives you, you know, the suggestion that you cultivate an art of judgment and be prudent.
Yes. And this actually is a good, I wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that you and I are two of very few people who have written about progressive foreign policy and realism, or like thinking about these two things at the same time. And you have this fantastic piece in Dissent magazine, which is called Realism's Imperial Origins. And some of that obviously comes from the book, but you make some like unique points in there that are not necessarily made in the book. So you say that like the modern realist restrainers are, quote, right to emphasize the correct value of the dissenting pragmatic strain of American realism. But the counsel of restraint, prudence, and other sensible virtues does not vindicate the much deeper claims about the nature of power, the political, the national, and the international that North Atlantic realists have made since the 1880s, when realism first emerged. End quote. I think I'm in violent agreement here, right? And this is recapitulating a little bit of what you said, but I mean, can you expand on that at all?
Yeah, I can. I mean, I think that like my peers who are critics of U.S. foreign policy and who broadly align themselves with a restraint-oriented foreign policy, less militarism and less hubris, less interventionism. But these are the correct posture because we should be consistent anti-imperialists. And part of my problem with the anti-hegemonic, Van, what you call the anti-hegemonic position, or what I refer to as the restraint position in my essay, is that they're not consistently anti-imperialist, and that they are quite pessimistic about and passive in the face of other imperialism. So I'm pro-restraint, but not because the world is as the classical realists or neo-realists describe it. I think that a thin,
yes, 100%,
prudential realism is appealing. And, you know, dialing back, you know, the forever war and the conceit of primacy, or the objective of primacy. But I don't think that it requires or vindicates a realist ontology. And so I sort of worry about all of this talk about the inevitability of great power competition and the need to accommodate our rivals as American hegemony wanes.
100%.
I'm not saying restraint is wrong, therefore we need to be liberal internationalists. I'm saying let's find a position beyond liberal internationalism and a restraint grounded in realism. Now, I did speak to Stephen Wertheim about this, and he sort of urged me to disaggregate those two and to say that restraint is a grand strategy that doesn't necessarily depend on realism. And so I take that point, and that's why I say that I would hate to see the wise aspects of restraint vindicate the thicker ontological claims about the nature of international affairs, the cyclical philosophy of history, and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. There's certainly convergence between a kind of anti-imperial, anti-liberal hegemonic foreign policy, progressive grand strategy preference, and certain preferences within classical realism or neoclassical realism. But as a progressive person, I would not want realism to be defining the horizon of statecraft, or like how far our foreign policy vision goes, what we're trying, the world we're trying to make, for, you know, lack of a better, that's my phrase in the journal article. Like, I don't want realism defining the world that we're trying to make. And so, like, to the extent restraint is a grand strategy, which would imply that it's like internally coherent, it has to own up to who benefits from the action, the restraint actions that you take. And you have to have that somewhat foregrounded, because if you don't, then a restraint that benefits in the extreme, you know, Putin, Nazi Germany, Assad, whatever, it takes you in a direction where you're kind of world making in a bad way, in a not children of the Enlightenment way, in a not progressive way.
Sort of going back to your point about psychology, I mean, I sort of wonder whether this kind of refusal of world making reflects an anxiety about a politics of hope, about pursuing any kind of, you know, real world making project that might turn out to be another God that failed. I think that we're I think we need to be a little bit bolder and more hopeful in, and that's why I liked the section of your paper on the progressive pragmatists and their aspiration to, you know, make the a world more social democratic, more equal, and so forth. And it seems like the restraint grand strategy, or anti-hegemonic grand strategy, has more of a negative vision, you know, of what to restrain rather than what to create.
Yeah, I mean, the way I thought, I can't remember if I put this explicitly in the paper, but I thought of all three progressive grand strategies as cashing out as versions of restraint. They're all restraint grand strategies, but in different ways, with different front-loaded principles, you know? And then, like any strategy, each has its own configuration of risks that it's willing to accept, you know? And that anti-hegemonic grand strategy, it is like you say, it's kind, the risk there is like, they don't want to take the risk that a progressive pragmatist orientation would take, because maybe they have grim expectations about what happens when you try to do good things. I don't know. And so the surest bet for that anti-hegemonic view is to just literally like do less, accommodate yourself to things as they are, presumptively, because that's as good as it gets.
Can I ask you a question that's been bothering me or on my mind, is what do you think about the idea of great power competition as the sort of meta narrative of where we are?
I mean, it's horrible.
I guess you have that piece with Michael Brennis that's beginning to get into that. But I wonder, because I feel like there's so much talk about the return of realism is becoming fashionable again, because we believe that history is binary. You know, it's sort of, you're either in this integrative globalizing mode, or you're in this model of great power competition. I just don't know, since I'm not an IR scholar, I want to know sort of what it, to me, it sounds like a repeat of a very old discourse. But what would be the defense of that as a paradigm for thinking about?
It's rhetorically lazy. Like, Nexon has actually made some good points on this. It's like, it's a language or a rhetoric that substitutes for, or it describes a framework of great power rivalry. And in that sense, it is implicitly realist, certainly rationalist. it is geopolitics in action, you know, but without kind of owning up to the full ontology that's being smuggled in. And so one of the ways that it's that we're airing right now, I think, and this Mike Brennis and I are working on a new book about this that expands on that foreign affairs piece, is the idea that like great Democrats in particular, Republicans are like going off the rails, like they're anti-democratic in many respects now. But the Democrats have this wager with foreign policy that they've started coalescing around that says great power competition, which is to say great power rivalry, which is to say an embrace of geopolitics and realism, is how you get a new great society, is how you get New Deal Order 2.0. And that requires a really, really fucked up reading of the Cold War and of New Deal history. It requires an extremely cherry-picked arc of history that erases all the risks that we took to make that happen, all of the hierarchy that we had to impose and perpetuate to keep that kind of order going. You know, there was no New Deal order without having a wife at home, right? Suppressing the feminist movement, basically. You couldn't have lots of high-wage working-class jobs in a factory. To say nothing of the fact that unionization then, compared to now, it's just a different universe, right? And so Democrats have this extremely bad and dangerous theory that mostly cashes out in favor of elites, particularly like oligarchs and foreign policy elites. Like the Washington establishment benefits uniquely from great power competition. It's a job program for Kennedy School graduates who learned a little bit of Mandarin, right? And that's fucking what it is. That and, you know, ununionized workers who are going to build semiconductors, it seems like, and getting, you know, shit wages and shit conditions. And that's the bet. And like, that's not going to work out, particularly because like what we saw in the Cold War, we went all in on this like anti-Soviet bet. We have the National Defense Education Act and all this stuff, you know? So like there's some, that's the historical basis for thinking you can get public goods out of having a geopolitical foe, you know? We Sputnik, you know, we technological innovation.
Yep.
But like that ignores how different the world, the social order was then. And that's a social order we don't want to repeat. But also by reaffirming and amplifying the Soviet threat, we gave the Republicans the opportunity to say, oh, we agree with the Soviet threat. Our theory for how to defeat the threat, and now that we're in power, we're going to fucking do it. Our theory for defeating the threat is to starve the welfare state. It is neoliberalism. It is austerity. It is we can't afford to fight the war on poverty. Who cares about poverty when you've got the big red menace, the big bad, you know? There's a way in which signing on to this like big geopolitical foe project really screwed over the very thing that Democrats wanted and think that they're getting again. And they're missing that history. So that was a long explanation, but like that's the thrust of like what I think is wrong with that. And great power competition is simply an idiom in which they're expressing this return to realism without being accountable for all that comes with a return to realism. And an offensive kind of realism too. Kind of like, this is what's so funny. Yep. It's kind of the Atlantic realism, the version that's about really about domination and empire. And like, that's very different from restraint realism, you know?
Yeah. And I try to allow that there are dissenting moments in realism's history,
sure,
that there is this what Jackson Lears calls the pragmatic realist tradition in American history. But I think these are marginal compared with the larger story of realism's imperial investments.
And cherry picking that's, again, yeah.
That's why I come at this from a bit of a different angle than some of my contemporaries.
Really fascinating stuff. I had one other big question sort of about...
Sure.
We've both read this Australian progressive foreign policy thing. There was a journal article a year or two ago about... It's channeling the Australian perspective specifically, but it was like a six author project. And they were trying to define what they called the progressive realism for Australian foreign policy. What were your thoughts about that in broad terms? Like there were things that converged with what I was doing and with what you're talking about, but it was also its own thing.
I have to confess, it's been a little while since I read it. I remember reading it and thinking myself in agreement with what was proposed, and yet still sort of uncomfortable with the label. But if you could refresh my memory about what are some of the...
To the extent, I thought it was a very good piece, and it's interesting to see a convergence just by an organic convergence across the pond or whatever on like progressively minded thinking about foreign policy. That one of my hangups was that they're using realism, but it wasn't clear what aspect of realism they were tapping into, particularly because the progressivism that they were tapping into was a redistributive progressivism, a redistribution of resources, a redistribution of power. Any social democratic function is, of course, going to have redistribution, like of material resources. But realism is a power hoarding idiom. It's not you don't share power, you know? I guess there's times when you can make accommodations within realism, but they were using the rhetoric of realism, and it wasn't clear which aspect they were tapping into when they did that. But I also questioned as part of that, like, was there a political reason for invoking a realist brand? Like, is there something going on in Australian strategic culture that makes this more sellable by appending realism to it? The way in the US we would talk about pragmatism, being practical, being realistic, you know, like, is it that kind of thing?
I mean, having talked to George Lawson a little bit about this, I think that he feels that there are some resources for progressive realism in thinkers like E.H. Carr that have not been, because there is a left, you know, dimension to E.H. Carr's thought. I have a dim memory of the article. I apologize for not rereading it, but I feel like there was some of that E.H. Carr influenced idea about sort of bringing things into equilibrium, sort of bringing politics into equilibrium with economics, or bringing...
I could see that.
There was something sort of about the sort of economic substructure that represented the real and needed to be taken seriously. But it also makes sense to me that, you know, that realism is as I try to show in my book, realism is the default setting, and then we sort of decorate it with adjectives like progressive, ethical, and so on. I'm skeptical about the prospect of a truly progressive realism for the reasons I've suggested in my book, but I am very interested in the dialogue, and you know, I've learned a great deal from Shoreman's work on, you know, interpreting the mid-century classical realists as being, you know, more friendly to the world state than we've recognized, more cosmopolitan. I'm open to that dialogue. It's just I keep running up against, as I said, these blind spots or weaknesses in realist theory. I don't think they have a real theory of the state. I don't think they have a very sophisticated view of political economy. And
yeah,
I don't find it to be the go-to place for reinventing, you know, a progressive foreign policy.
Yeah. I mean, I don't plant a flag in cosmopolitanism or anything. That's not even an orientation in my mind. But I do have a piece coming out with the title, I think it's Real Security is Beyond the National Interest. And I think that's the thing I keep coming up against, like you said, with realism, is like, it's about that horizon. Like, it's conceivable that we would agree on so many things, but we cannot hand over our political vision and the imaginary of world making to the realists, because they confine us to this arbitrary boundary of the national interest. And real security requires going further than that. There are many ways to cut into that, but that's the minimum, I think, in my mind. Well, this has been a long one, man. But this has been great. I've had
those were great questions. I apologize for not having a better answer on the last question.
There's no wrong answers here.
I got so into your Left of Liberal Internationalism article that I didn't have time to reread the Lawson.
All right. Well, we'll stay in touch. This has been great. The Atlantic Realists, get it while it's hot, or even after it's not hot anymore. All right, Matthew Spector, thanks for coming on the show, man. This has been great.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.